In fact, between 2 and 3 in the morning, he had switched the license plates of the rented car and the black truck. "After that heavy dinner," she said. She giggled. "Did you use my bed in Kanya?" he asked. "Of course, our bed." He said, "I'm hungry." She put on a slightly perplexed face. She said, "This is your apartment." "Yes." "How come Sylvia's in the master bedroom and you and I are in a single bed in a guest room?" "I don't know." "You don't know?" "I guess it's like the Latin American expression, I lost the battle of the street." "Was there a revolution?" "There must have been. I guess I was in absentee government."
"What does that mean?"
"I wasn't here a couple of nights."
"Where were you?"
"I was working."
"Working?"
"At a newspaper. An old boy I worked with in Chicago works for a paper here now. He was short-handed and asked me to come in. Charlestown was burning down again."
"Why would you do that?"
"Why not?"
"Why should you?"
"I liked it. Anyhow, Jack had let me spend some time at the newspaper looking up Haran."
"Jack?"
"Jack Saunders."
"I doubt it would take 2 nights for Charlestown to burn down."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, I would expect your friend to solve his staff problems by the 2nd night.
"I don't get you."
"You said you were gone 2 nights.
"Did I say that?"
"Where were you on the other night?"
"What other night?"
"You were only gone 1 night."
"Ah."
"If you were only gone 1 night, how come Sylvia has the master bedroom?" "How come she has it anyway?"
"Who, Sylvia?"
"Were you sleeping with Sylvia?"
"Who, me?"
"You see, Fletch?"
"See what?"
"Don't give me a hard time."
"Did I give you a hard time?"
"About Bart."
"Oh, yeah, Bart the woman slayer."
"He needed help, Fletch."
"I'll bet."
"You know why his wife left him?"
"I heard rumors."
"Then this girl he wanted to take to Kanya finally refused to go."
"I know. I found her body. She should have gone."
"Bart never killed anybody."
"Andy, one of 3 people killed Ruth Fryer. I know I didn't, and Bart tops the list of the other 2 candidates.
"Tell me about Sylvia."
"Sylvia who?"
"Come on.
You must have misunderstood something."
"I did not. You've never lost a battle of the street in your life."
"I haven't known many Sylvias."
"What happened?"
"I was raped."
"That's nice."
"Not bad."
"I don't believe you."
"Believe me. I think you figured out she wants the paintings as much as you do."
"She's not going to get them, is she?"
"I know what she has to offer. What do you have to offer?"
"You know what I have to offer."
"You're skinnier than she is."
"You like that, skinny."
"Did I say that?"
"Once or twice."
"Was I telling the truth?"
"One never knows."
"We're doing an awful lot of talking, for 2 friends who haven't seen each other in almost a week."
"I'm not used to making deals in bed."
"Oh, then feel sorry for me."
"Why should I feel sorry for you?"
"I was raped. I need to get my sexual confidence back."
"You have it back. I can feel it."
"See how much good you've done already?" Chapter 34 Fletch went into the den to answer the telephone after a 2nd helping of scrambled eggs and sausage. It was 10:00, and Sylvia apparently had gone out earlier to follow her own investigation, which Fletch guessed meant walking through Boston's private galleries with a list of Degrassi paintings in her hand. It was, finally, a cloudless October day. At breakfast, Fletch and Andy had decided to spend the day walking the old streets. She said she would show him his American history. He worried about the moon. It was Haran.
"Mr. Fletcher, I was able to get Mr. Cooney on the phone last night. Too late to call you back."
"That was very considerate of you. I did go to bed early."
"There was little point in rushing to you with the news anyway."
"Oh?"
"He says he won't respond to your new offer for the Picasso either. Contrary to my advice to you, he says you're not even in the ballpark."
"Did you remind him he has 8 kids to feed?"
"He said he is looking for upwards of $1 million for the painting."
"Hungry kids. I thought beef was cheaper in Texas."
"That's the lay of the land. I don't know if you want to go further with this negotiation, but I expect you want to think about it."
"Would you? I mean, would you go further?"
"I think I would. I think I'd make another offer for it. Of course, I have no idea how much of your resources you want to tie up in a single property." Will you make another offer if I don't?
Mr. Fletcher, I think I made a mistake there, one for which I apologize, in indicating to you I might be interested in purchasing this painting if you don't. I'm your broker in this case, and a client should never feel he would be in the position where he must bid against his own broker.
I was wondering about that.
I was greatly mistaken. What I meant was, if this negotiation between you and Cooney doesn't work out, after a decent interval of time, and it would be a long, decent interval, I might reopen negotiations with Mr. Cooney on my own, or even conceivably in behalf of another client.
I see.
As long as you leave your negotiation with Mr. Cooney open, you will not be bidding against me, or any other client of mine, even potentially. I will continue to give you my best advice to make your negotiation successful.
And what's your advice now?
First, I think you should think about it. No reason for being too swift in these matters. After you consider your own resources and the very real question of how much of those resources you want committed to a single property, I'd make a new offer if I were so inclined.
How much?
The new offer? I think $800,000.
I'll think about it.
All right, Mr. Fletcher, call me any time.
What about the other painting?
What other painting?
The Boccioni. The red space.
Oh, a complete blank.
Really?
I guess I was too subtle at first. He had no idea what I was talking about. I finally asked him more directly. Mr. Cooney clearly had never heard of Umberto Boccioni.
That's puzzling.
I guess your source of information was dead wrong.
That's hard to believe.
Nothing's hard to believe in this business, Mr. Fletcher. Whoever told you Mr. Cooney owns a Boccioni was incorrect. Call me when you decide about the Picasso.
I will. Andy was clearing the dishes from the dining room table. That was Horan, Fletch said. Our man in Texas never heard of Umberto Boccioni.
Chapter 35. Trusting the two plainclothesmen would not be too puzzled by his not using the Ford gear, Fletch took a taxi to Flynn's office on Craigie Lane. It was a gray stone pile at the edge of Boston Harbor. Inside, everything was painted regulation green except the sagging wooden floors, which were soft underfoot. The policeman behind the counter sent him up a curved staircase with a heavy carved wooden railing. Grover was making tea in a corridor alcove on the second floor. He led Fletch into Flynn's office. Flynn was behind an old wooden desk, and behind him three arched, almost cathedral-like windows overlooked the harbor. A few straight-backed wooden chairs stood about the room in no particular order. Along the inside wall was a long wooden refectory table.
Did you bring Mr. Fletcher a cup of tea as well, Grover?
Flynn stood up to shake hands.
Pull up a pew, Mr. Fletcher. Make yourself at home.
Grover placed the two teacups at the edge of the desk and went out to get a third.
We'll have a nice little tea party.
Fletch moved one of the wooden chairs to be at an angle to the desk so he would have solid wall behind Flynn, not the late afternoon light from the windows.
Homie, said Fletch.
I know.
Behind his desk, Flynn's elfin face looked like that of a schoolboy playing teacher.
I came to look at you in an off moment Saturday, and you came to look at me in an off moment Sunday. That was our weekend. I learned you're a peeping Tom besides being a reporter and a murderer, either one of which is bad enough. But did we accomplish anything else?
After handing Fletch a cup of tea without questions regarding cream and sugar, there was neither in the cup, Grover took his own cup and dragged a chair over to the long table against the wall.
You do want me to take notes, Inspector?
For what they're worth. I think Mr. Fletcher has something important to say, and I want a witness.
Fletch asked,
How's the murder going? The chubby city council person's murder?
Slowly, said reluctant Flynn. Very time-consuming, to be sure.
Was the axe murder solved?
Oh, of course. Such things are usually family matters. I don't know why we bother with them at all.
Look, regarding the Ruth Fryer business, it's called murder.
Yes.
I want off the hook.
You want to go to Texas?
Probably.
We'll be pleased to let you off the hook as soon as we find a more attractive candidate for charging than yourself.
Fletch said, I would guess not too much has been accomplished in recent days.
Will you listen to that, Grover? The candidate for hanging is getting impatient. And he had such a great lot of faith in the institution of the Boston police to begin with.
At the side of the room, Grover sat hunched over his table, writing slowly.
I quite understand you've got other things to do, Fletch said.
One or two.
And undoubtedly there's a lot of political and press pressure on you regarding the city council person's murder.
I thank you for making my excuses.
But I'm being sort of a victim here. I didn't kill Ruth Fryer.
You say you didn't.
And the investigation has been dragging on almost a week now.
Mr. Fletcher, the complaint apartment is downstairs. It's a small room with see-through walls.
Another person in my position might have hired private detectives this last week.
However, being a great ex-investigative reporter yourself, you've done a little investigating on your own, is that it?
Yes.
And have you come to a conclusion?
I think I have.
Do you want time to sharpen your pencil, Grover? Oh, it's a pen. I don't want you to miss a word.
Okay, said Fletch. First of all, it's most likely the murderer must have had a key to the apartment. Not absolutely necessary. Thinking Bart Connors was in Italy and the apartment was empty, Ruth Fryer could have gone to the apartment alone or with some other person to use the apartment for sexual purposes. Or, not knowing Connors was in Italy, to surprise him. She could have had a key, which the murderer then took. Or Joan Winslow, in a state of advanced intoxication, could have let her in.
All highly unlikely, said Flynn. The Winslow woman supposedly was at the Bullfinch pub. Ruth Fryer would have seen your suitcases in the hall, noted the airline's tags in the name of Peter Fletcher, and been scared off from whichever course of action she intended. For the last time, Mr. Fletcher, I reject the idea that Ruth Fryer killed herself.
Narrow of you, said Fletch, but I accept it. So, he continued, the basic question is, who had a key to that apartment?
Me, he counted himself off on his little finger.
Mrs. Sawyer, whom you've investigated?
As pure as little Eva.
Joan Winslow?
Ach, she's incapable of anything.
Bart Connors?
Now, he's a real possibility. How come we haven't thought of him, Grover?
And Lucy Connors?
Lucy Connors?
Let's consider Bart Connors first.
You've been considering Bart Connors from the very beginning. You've been after him, so the man has my sympathy.
Apparently, Fletch was hanging on to his index finger.
6 months ago, Bart Connors had a sexual psychological shock. His wife left him for a woman. Mrs. Sawyer said he then became sexually very active. He is known to have brought girls to his apartment. We thought he had gone to Italy on Sunday. He did not leave Boston until 9:30 Tuesday night, and then he flew through Montreal, a sort of unusual thing to do. Just prior to the murder, Joan Winslow said she saw him in a pub 2 blocks away with the girl she has identified as Ruth Fryer.
She's an unreliable witness. Any defense attorney would make a hash of her in minutes.
Flynn, why isn't Bart Connors the murderer?
I don't know.
We know he delayed his departure from Boston because he was trying to talk a girl into going to Italy with him, a girl who ultimately refused.
Well, I have a prejudice against him. He's a Boston lawyer, you know, an important firm.
All of which just means he's smart enough to lay the crime off on someone else.
I don't know why he'd need to. I don't know why he wouldn't have taken the body and dumped it in some alley.
He had a plane to catch. He was well known in the neighborhood. It was still early evening. He knew I'd be arriving.
All good reasons. But Ruth Fryer had not had sexual intercourse.
That's it, Flynn. Her rejecting him after his experience with his wife may have sent him up the wall.
May have.
Frankly, Flynn, I don't think you've paid enough attention to Bart Connors as a suspect.
Grover, pay more attention to Bart Connors as a suspect.
Incidentally, something else you don't know is that Ruth Fryer's boyfriend, whose name is Clay Robinson, flew up from Washington Tuesday afternoon to spend a few days with her.
Did he? Grover, our incompetence is becoming marked.
Presuming Ruth Fryer knew Bart Connors and thought he was in Italy, why wouldn't she have taken Clay Robinson to use Bart's apartment?
Why would she when there are hotels?
It's a nice place.
Wouldn't she have had to explain to her boyfriend how it was she had access to such an apartment?
I suppose so.
She had no key we know of, Mr. Fletcher. Your tagged luggage was in the hall.
Okay. Now we come to Joan Winslow.
My God, Grover, it's like listening to one of those Harvard Radcliffe professors. Such a pompous lecture we're getting.
Flynn, I'm tired of being a murder suspect.
I'd say you've got pretty good evidence those paintings are in Texas.
Flynn's voice was barely audible across the desk.
You want to get out of here.
Inspector, I didn't catch that, Grover said.
You weren't meant to. Go on, Mr. Fletcher. Joan Winslow has a key to the apartment. She was in love with Bart Connors, passionately. He had rejected her quite thoroughly. She hated, absolutely hated the young girls he'd been bringing to his apartment. So how would that work in time and space? I don't know. Joan Winslow heard something in Bart's apartment, knew he was in Italy, went over to investigate, found Ruth Fryer naked, thinking she was waiting for Bart. Joan went into a drunken rage and slugged her with the bottle. Who put the other whiskey bottles away? I mean, who cleaned off the whole liquor bar? Joan Winslow did. She knew the apartment. I guess she knew I was coming in. Or she saw the suitcases and knew I was going to return. Or she simply wanted to frame Bart Connors. That's a possibility. Joan Winslow has made an even greater effort than I have to blame Bart Connors. She identified Ruth Fryer as being the girl she saw in the pub with him. When do we get to consider all the evidence against you? Grover's getting anxious over there. I think you've done enough of that. You've considered me such a prime suspect, you've done little else. Now, what haven't we done? I'll tell you what you haven't done. You didn't find Ruth Fryer's motel key. By the way, you never gave it to me. You didn't need it. You didn't know Joan Winslow has a key to Bart Connors' apartment. That was thick of us. Sheer inexperience on my part. You didn't know Ruth Fryer's boyfriend, Clay Robinson, was in Boston Tuesday afternoon. How were we to know that? You haven't talked with Bart Connors. Oh, him again. You sound like a Christmas phonograph. Reindeer and snowflakes and bright shining stars over and over again. And the most significant thing of all, I don't even think you've thought of doing. We've had the city council person's murder. You're not going to send me to prison, Flynn, because you're distracted. Such a scolding I'm getting. You sound like Grover. A more experienced policeman might resent it. Sorry, Flynn, but I want to get moving. You've mentioned it. Lucy Connors, said Fletch. Ah, yes, Lucy Connors. She has a key to the apartment. Has she? Have you talked with her? Yes. Very enterprising of you. When could that have been? Does she live in Brookline? Yes. Ah, you went there Sunday morning before paying your visit to me. Flynn, Lucy Connors flew into Boston from Chicago Tuesday afternoon on Transworld Airlines. My God. Furthermore, she made an excuse to her roommate for being late. She was late by 2 or 3 hours. Very enterprising of you, Mr. Fletcher. Very enterprising indeed. She has a history of violence, which she admits. She used to beat up her husband, send him to the office with welts. She and her girlfriend still play with sexual violence. You must have been a very good investigative reporter, Mr. Fletcher, to know what two people do in bed. Lucy Connors flies into Boston. Her eye is taken by ground hostess Ruth Fryer. She picks her up, maybe with some story about her boutique. Ruth is young and innocent and never dreams this older woman has sexual designs on her. They go to Ruth's hotel, where she changes into a pretty dress, because, after all, this older woman, her new friend, has been in Chicago buying for her boutique. She doesn't wait for Clay Robinson because she doesn't know he's coming. Ruth is an airline stewardess, bored in a city she doesn't know, about to get married in a month or two. Another girl asks her to join her for drinks, dinner, the evening. Why shouldn't she go? She feels perfectly safe. We have to think in these terms, don't we? Said Flynn. A man and a woman can check into a hotel together, but eyebrows still rise at two women doing so. I expect so. Lucy can't take Ruth Fryer home with her because Marcia's at the apartment waiting. So, said Flynn, knowing Bart's in Italy, either not knowing about your arrival or not caring, as she had a perfect right to use the Connors' apartment, they not being divorced yet, she brings Ruth Fryer to what is technically your apartment at that point. Yeah. And at the apartment, Ruth discovers she, in fact, is being seduced. She's a young girl. She's about to be married. She's not that way. She's straight. She resists. Her dress gets torn from her. She runs down the hall. Lucy, who enjoys violent play, chases her down the hall. Also, Lucy is not very experienced at seducing girls. She loses her head. Maybe she's hurt at being rejected. Maybe she goes into a blind rage. And she cracks little Ms. Fryer over the head with a whiskey bottle. Dusts the bottle and puts it back. She puts all the other bottles in the salt and pepper cabinet, knowing Mrs. Sawyer will have to move them around. Her own fingerprints wouldn't make any difference anyway. And she puts out a carafe of water, knowing that when you return to the apartment and find the body after dinner, it would be any man's normal instinct to pour himself a stiff one at the sideboard. Thus she got your fingerprints on the murder weapon. Right. Damned clever. How did you get to interview Lucy Connors? I said I was from a magazine.
I see. It seems you've done better than we have, Fletcher.
The thing that's been puzzling since the beginning, said Fletch, is that this murder appeared to be a crime of sexual passion. The victim was naked, she was beautiful. And yet the autopsy turned up no evidence of sexual intercourse.
That was surprising, said Flynn.
There would be no such evidence if the sexual affair was lesbian.
My God, it's been in front of our eyes all the time.
Lucy has a key. She and Ruth were at the airport at the same time. She would be attracted to Ruth. Anyone would be. She and Ruth could not go to a hotel easily or safely. Lucy is known to be violence prone. Ruth would have resisted her.
An arrest, said Flynn, standing up from his desk, is imminent.
58 Fenton Street, Brookline, said Fletch, also standing. Apartment 42, under the name of Marcia Hauptmann.
Have you got that, Grover?
Yes, Inspector.
Now, Frank, said Fletch, would you do me a favor?
It seems I owe you one.
Get your goons off my back.
I will indeed. Grover, order Mr. Fletcher's tail removed immediately.
Yes, sir.
And will you be at home later tonight, Mr. Fletcher?
I expect to be later.
Perhaps I'll give you a call to tell you how things turn out.
I'd appreciate that.
I'm sure you will, Mr. Fletcher. I'm sure you will.
Chapter 36. Both Andy and Sylvia marveled when Fletch donned blue jeans, boots, a dark blue turtleneck sweater, navy windbreaker, and a Greek fisherman's cap, and said he was going out for a while. He said he would be back for dinner.
He wouldn't.
Although free of his police tail, out of habit he went through the kitchen and down the service stairs of the apartment house. Going through the alley to his garage on River Street was a shortcut anyway. In the black truck, Fletch put himself on Newbury Street and headed west. The two top stories of 60 Newbury Street were lit. He crossed Massachusetts Avenue, down the ramp, and continued west on the Massachusetts Turnpike extension. Lolling along, singing to himself while munching pretzels, he took the western exit, went left at a light, and curved right up a grade after a second light. The moon was out. Climbing, after he passed the golf course, he had a better view of the antique farmhouses close to the road and the well-separated estate houses set back. Passing the Horan house, he noted it showed no light. He continued on into Weston Center. Next to a drugstore on the main road was a lit telephone booth. Fletch parked at an angle next to it and checked his watch. It was 9:05 Monday night. He had been in Massachusetts about 6 days and 6 hours. Despite the dim light emanating from the drugstore, he knew it was closed. In the phone booth, he dialed the Boston number of Ronald Rizom Horan. The man answered immediately. Chewing gum in mouth, thumb pressed against his left nostril, Fletch said,
"Mr. Horan?
Yeah, this is the Weston Police.
Your burglar alarm just went off.
Yeah, the light just lit on the console here.
Is someone at the house now?
Yeah, a burglar is, I guess.
Are the police there?
Oh, yeah. We're sending the car over as soon as we can locate it.
What do you mean, as soon as you can locate it?
Yeah, they're not answering the radio just now.
Jesus! Listen, you jerk. Get someone to the house right away.
Yeah, I'll do what I can.
I'll be out right away.
Yeah, okay. You know where the police station is?
I'm not going to the police station, you jerk. I'm going to the house.
The phone slammed down. Taking his time, Fletch drove back to Horan's house, down the driveway. He drove behind the house to the garage. His headlights picked up the dirt track around the right of the garage. He drove around the garage. His headlights swept the area as he turned. He backed the black truck into the tractor shed and turned out the headlights. Walking back around the garage, he saw that the back and side of the house were bathed in moonlight. It was easy to find a big enough stone. On the back porch, being careful to lay his bare fingers nowhere but on the stone, he re-examined the alarm system carefully. There were 6 small panes of glass in the back door. Each pane had 2 wires of the alarm system zigzagging through it, from left to right, top and bottom. Very carefully, with the stone, he smashed the pane of glass nearest the door handle, knocking out both wires. The alarm went off, a high, excited, shrill, piercing, truly frightening ringing. His mind's eye saw a light beginning to flash at a console at the Weston Police Station. As he went down the porch stairs, he pitched the stone into the woods. He crossed the driveway to the bushes. In the bright moonlight, he stood, silently, further back in the bushes than he wanted to, but he still had clear views of the driveway, the side, and back of the house. Soon he saw the huge lights of the Rolls-Royce traveling north on the road. It braked as it approached the driveway. The lights streamed down the gravel. Horan turned the car so the headlights flooded the back porch of the house. He dashed across the gravel and up the steps. His feet crunched on the broken glass. He stooped to examine the window. Using his key, he let himself into the house. The kitchen light went on. In a moment, the burglar alarm was turned off. No lights went on in the front of the house. Dim lights, as from a stairwell, mixed with the moonlight on the window surfaces at the back of the house, both downstairs and upstairs. Then lights went on in an upstairs room at the back of the house. Light poured through its two windows. Other than the kitchen, the room in the center of the second story was the only room fully lit. There was a noise from the road to Fletcher's left. Blue lights rotating on the top of a police car came down the driveway. There was no sound of a siren. The light in the room on the second floor went off. The policeman parked behind the rolls. Going around it, one of the policemen brushed his fingers along a fender. Horan appeared at the back door. "You, Mr. Horan? What took you guys so goddamned long?" "We came as soon as we got the call." "Like hell you did. I got out from Boston sooner." "Is this your car?" "Never mind about that. What the hell am I paying taxes for if this is the kind of protection I get?" The policemen were climbing the steps, their wide belts and holsters making them look heavy-hipped. "You pay your taxes, Mr. Horan, because you have to." "What's your name?" "Officer Cabot, sir, badge number 92. The other policeman said, "The glass is smashed, Chuck." "Christ," said Horan. "Anything missing?" asked Cabot. "No." "The alarm must have scared them off." "The alarm had to scare them off," said Horan. "Nothing else would." "We can patch that up with a piece of plywood and some tacks." Cabot said, "Let's look around anyway." Lights went on and off throughout the whole house as Horan showed them around. The ground was cold. Fletch began to feel it in his boots. The three men were fiddling about the back door. The policemen were helping Horan tack a piece of plywood on the inside of the door over the window frames. "You live here or in Boston?"
"Both places."
"You should get this window fixed first thing in the morning."
"You're no one to tell me my business," said Horan.
The policemen came down the steps and ambled toward their car. From the porch, Horan said, "Get here a little faster next time, will you?" Turning, the car reversed and headed up the driveway. Its rotating blue lights went out. Horan returned to the house and turned out all the lights. He closed and locked the back door. Moving slowly, he came down the porch steps, got into the car, reversed it a few meters, and drove up the driveway. As soon as the Rolls taillights disappeared around the curve, Fletch hurried across the driveway and up the porch steps.